Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mehler here. And, you know, it's always fun to talk about birds with today's guest, Bill Volker. Great to have Bill back. He's a retired wildlife DNR educator, naturalist. He worked at Horicon Marsh for 27 years. He's written books on the topic and has led many bird watching tours many out of the country, for sure. And we'll probably talk a little bit about that as we visit with him. But birds, the topic today, tell us about the birds you love to watch. Maybe you need some help identifying a bird. Maybe you have a question about bird feeding. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. If you had a photo, you could send that along as well. Bill Volker, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Larry. Hi to you, and certainly to all the listeners.
We are in the middle of what could generously be called a cold snap across the state. And we had somewhere in the Madison area, something like 18 inches of snow fell over a four-day period. How do birds handle these temperatures and the weather?
Well, it's certainly stressful on them. There's no doubt about that. And, yeah, this is a pretty severe winter weather. As you mentioned, it's not just the cold, but also the accumulated snow. And that puts stresses on them. It makes it a little bit more difficult for finding the food that they require. Of course, this time of year, it's not just the coldest time of the year. We also have the shortest days and the longest nights, which means there's only so many hours to find food, load up, and then that long night to make it through. And no doubt, anybody who out there among those birds that's not in top-notch shape, some of them just may not make it, which is why in coming spring we've got a nesting season to replace them, rebuild those populations. But the vast majority of the birds do survive. They always have. Keep that in mind. And I have a hard time really reconciling this in my mind. Is it that the birds are just so well adapted and so tough, or are we just that wimpy that we're so poorly equipped to make it through this? You and I and everyone else out there, I'm sure we limit the amount of time, or if we don't have to go out, you don't want to, and if you can avoid it, I mean, no more than about 15 minutes, half hour, unless something really urges you. Birds are out there 24 hours. This is the world they live in. But as I said, this is where they have always lived, and if they hadn't adapted to it, they wouldn't have made it. But it's not so much the cold. It's all about food. But it's the cold that demands much more energy. And, of course, the other problem now is with the snow that we have, it's buried a lot of food. And on top of that, it started out as a really wet snow, which means it's stuck to a lot of things. So you look at the trees and the shrubs, they're just encased in that snow. So the food that's normally available out there is pretty well hidden right now and covered up, which means that bird feeders, which normally are just sort of a convenience stop, are right now kind of an emergency. And so if you're not feeding birds, something you might want to do, it livens up your winter, certainly, to look out the window and see something out there. And keep those feeders full. I find right now that my mixed seed, the birds aren't hitting all that much. Sunflower seed, I am filling those feeders at least once a day, especially the black oil sunflower. The even the smaller finches, like goldfinches, can handle it. And it's a very high nutritious, high energy food for them. So they have been really hitting it. And I'm trying to make sure that those feeders are full so that there's always some offerings for them.
I think about my feeders. I wind up with a lot of sparrows at my feeder these days. And we have a lot of cardinals in our neighborhood, so I'll see a few cardinals. But and those are typical birds that I guess we'd see, but there are many others.
Well, you've got, first of all, our year-round residents, birds that just don't migrate anywhere. And cardinals, you mentioned, that's certainly one. It's a year-round resident. Chickadees, several of the woodpeckers, nuthatches, blue jays and crows, these are year-round birds. So we do see migration of the Canadian populations. Mm-hmm. Late fall, you'll see blue jays coming down, especially the Mississippi River Valley. And the question in my mind is, are the blue jays we're seeing right now in our backyards and around the neighborhoods, are those the same ones that are sticking around, or are they being somewhat replaced or joined by some of these northern birds? but it's certainly a species that we see throughout the year. And I would really divide birds up in a couple of groups. So there are, as we just mentioned, the non-migrants, the year-round residents, they're here. We also have the northern migrants, so the juncos and some of the northern finches. These are birds that consider Wisconsin down south.
Yeah.
And among those finches, the pine siskin, the purple finch, the red poles, and not so much a feeder bird, but the crossbills, these are birds that really are irregular migrants. They're nomads in the wintertime. They just move with where that natural food is. And every so often in Canada, certain species of the conifer trees just have a poor crop year. Weather conditions during the summer growing season are such they just don't produce a lot across a big region. And when that happens, they bail out and we get the invasion of these birds. So they're considered to be irregular migrants or eruptive migrants. And in Canada, if they don't come down, they may actually shift from, say, Gatherington, far eastern part of the country, or into the west, wherever that food is. So there's not a regular migration as we would think of going from point A to B.
Yeah.
And as I say, some of the northern ones. Then we also have short-distance migrants. Our robins, song sparrows, a number of these summer birds really don't leave the United States. They're just going down south beyond the snow line, and that's good enough for them. We also have some birds that'll stick it out about as long as they can, Canada geese and sandhill cranes. And I was seeing some discussion and reports of, as this cold weather and storm was rolling in, people are still seeing hundreds of cranes in southern Wisconsin in places. There was quite a worry. What about them? Well, if they thought it was a problem, they would have left.
Yeah.
So there was plenty of waste grain, which is really what they're feeding on, especially the picked corn, what's laying out in those fields. As long as they have access to it. Now we've got a foot of snow, or in some places, 18 inches of snow. Well, that's way too much to try to look for. So when the storm came in, I had mentioned to some of the people that if the birds hadn't left just in advance of the storm, they're just going to hunker down, wait for it to pass, and then they're going to move right after that. They're still in plenty good shape. And basically for Canada geese and along with our cranes, when you get about 6 inches of snow, it's just too much work to look for the food. So their migration is really dependent on snow cover, how far they go. And then we have the long-distance migrants, which are a lot of our summer birds. The vast majority of them are insectivores. And, of course, there are no insects out there except for the dormant ones that the woodpeckers are excavating. They're going all the way down into Mexico, Central America, and even South America. And those are birds that leave long before we ever see this weather. They've got to depart before the insect populations decline with the first heavy frost in fall. In other words, they don't know what weather we're getting.
Sure.
You're sitting in Central America. You don't care. You don't know. And they move well in advance of these kinds of weather systems.
Our guest today, Bill Volkert, we're talking birds as normal with Bill. It's always fun to have him on the show. Join in. Questions 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. And some emails, and we've got some phone calls. So let's go to Angie first in Milwaukee. Angie, thank you for calling.
Hi, and thank you for being on the show. We have had wonderful warblers and diversity of birds at our water, at our bird bath 3 years ago. But since there have been Cooper's hawks in the neighborhood increasing nesting and observations, we have seen our diversity go down. And more recently in the fall, we saw three plunder pools of feathers in our evergreens. And so we no longer see hardly any birds at our bird bath, and we consider it just a buffet for our local Cooper's hawk. So I'm wondering if there's anything that we can do to deter a Cooper's hawk from coming in.
Okay. Yeah, it's oftentimes disheartening. You'll see a predatory bird like this, which can be exciting, and then he comes by and snatches a cardinal right off the bird feeder. And the best thing that you could do is, if the bird is visiting at this time of year, which is outside of the nesting season, if they're starting to use your feeder as an easy hunting ground, just shut down the feeder for a week or so. The bird will move on as the songbirds disperse. And with that, they'll come back again afterwards. So you don't want to be setting up a two-stage feeding system where you're putting out the seed, bringing in the songbirds, and that's making it easy for the hawks. Now, you mentioned you've got one nesting in the area. Well, a couple of things. These birds have always lived with those predators. And like any predator, they're taking sometimes the more vulnerable ones, somewhat culling that flock. It's not having, say, an overall impact on the total population. So the populations are usually healthy enough. It can be a very localized impact. And I think in a way it's just something we have to live with. Hawks have their place out there in nature, too. And they're not going to be there always, so give it a few seasons for nesting and see if things don't change again over time.
Here you go,
it's just
Angie.
Something to live with, I suppose. That's nature.
Thank you for calling, Angie. Jody in Caledonia, Minnesota, we go to you. Hi, Jody.
Hello. Thank you again. Love your conversation. We are going through 50 pounds of spoiled sunflower seed a week and enjoying quite a variety, but the best variety is every morning I have between 6 to 8 bluebirds at the heated bird bath, but yet the last 2 to 3 years, none of my bluebird boxes have had families. So I'm kind of wondering, are they hanging around and why, especially now when we've had such sub-zero stuff, and anything else I should do to help them move on or keep them here?
They'll move on if they feel like they need to move on. I think just supply the food that you have been to make sure that they've got something available. You're not keeping them here by feeding them. And that's always been a bit of a myth, especially, say, with hummingbirds. People have said that, we should stop feeding in fall because that's what keeps them from migrating. The migration, that's really something that is signaled by the environment itself, and the birds will move when they feel they need to. For those that aren't moving, you're at least doing the right thing by providing food. Bluebirds, just like robins, which are in the same family, they're short-distance migrants. And we do pick up bluebirds and occasionally robins on the Christmas bird counts in Wisconsin, especially the southern part of the state. So it's not unusual that we'll have a few of them that are hanging out here. Why? Apparently they find that there's enough food for them out in the wild, especially on the berry freeze-dried berries that are out there on the bushes.
Sure.
And so, as I say, they're not lost. They're not stranded or anything. They just decided to hang out. And you've got to consider that for a bird like that to fly, say, all the way to the southern United States, yes, there might be better conditions down there, but it's going to take a lot of energy to get there. And it's a bit of a trade-off or a gamble for them. Do you just save up your energy, hang here, and hope that you've got enough energy to get you through a cold snap and a snowstorm? Or do you try to use that for migration? And I don't know what's always going on in the minds of those birds, but apparently some of them decided to stay. I just saw a robin yesterday myself as I was driving. So, yeah, there's a few that are hanging around. And, you know, it does seem almost inexplicable that a bird like that, that we think of as a summer bird, that they hang around in this weather. But I guess in some ways they're a lot tougher than we think.
Bill Volkert, our guest, you can join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, as we talk birds with Bill. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert's our producer today. Trina LaSusa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Talking birds today with our guest, Bill Volkert, retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist. Always great to have Bill come by. You can join in 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. Bob from Madison called, couldn't stay with us, but wonders, is it possible to move a screech owl nest? There's one in his area that might have to be moved because of construction.
Well, screech owls are cavity nesters. So it's one of our smaller owls, so only the saltwhite is smaller than that. And they'll use hollows in trees, either the pileated, or it's also pronounced pileated, woodpecker. That's a large enough hole, or even some of the flicker holes might be big enough for them to move into, or a natural cavity or not in a tree. I've also seen them at least roosting in wood duck boxes. I don't know if there's a lot of nesting in there. I've actually found pellets in some of my wood duck boxes when I clean them out, so I know that occasionally use it as a roost site. Actually, to move it, you know, the bird's going to go where he needs to. I think what you might want to do is you can't physically move that nest or the space for it, but give it an alternative. Try a screech owl box. Take a look around. See what you've got. See if you can give them something else so that when there is something that is removed because of the construction, he's at least got some options and some alternatives in the neighborhood.
Jeff in Superior, your turn today. Hi, Jeff. Thank you for calling.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. Good morning. It's a beautiful sunny day up here. I really have a couple questions. Where do robins go in the winter? You know, that's Wisconsin state bird. Mm-hmm. And are we going to see blue jays all winter because of its short, you know, season?
Robins, from some of the banding reports, it seems that a lot of our robins are going down to Arkansas, Oklahoma, into eastern Texas. So no doubt some of those will scatter a little bit across those southern states. So, you know, different individuals, as I said, some of them will even remain here. So if you kind of look from southern Wisconsin down straight down to Mississippi River Valley, they sort of spread out throughout that area. But that seems to be the major migratory or wintering site for them. Blue jays, as I say, it's a year-round bird. I've noticed in my neighborhood some years they're more abundant than others. Is that because of food that's available for them? Is it nesting success or just during wintertime as somewhat locally nomadic that they're just moving for other food sources? I've had a number of people tell me that their numbers also seem to come and go from year to year. And, you know, it's a little unpredictable for the blue jays just where they may hang out for the wintertime. But as I said, the northern population does move out of Canada. It gets a little too stressful for them. Here in Wisconsin, we've got them mostly as a year-round population, perhaps way up in that northern tier of counties. Especially with this kind of a weather, we may see them also make some short-distance migrations. So there may be some diminishing of the numbers up there.
Okay. Pam and Gordon emailed us. She wants some tips for attracting cardinals. She's in a forested parcel with primarily pines and mm-hmm. gets many bird species, but has not been successful in attracting cardinals on a regular basis.
Well, the cardinal, as I said, is not a migratory bird. It's a permanent resident. But the population has actually been slowly moving north over the last 100 years. Believe it or not, if you go back into the 1800s, the only cardinal that was ever reported in Wisconsin was Racine County.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Fond du Lac County, it wasn't until the 1940s that they showed up there. And we're not quite sure what the reason is that something's made it a more favorable environment. Is it something with changes in agriculture, backyard bird feeding, landscaping, land uses that somehow made it a little bit more suitable? But the cardinal and all right along with it, the red-bellied woodpecker has been slowly advancing its population north. We do have cardinal sightings up to that south shore of Lake Superior. I think the far northeast corner with the heavy, dense woods are probably the only place where we don't see either any or very few. So it's a bird of the edge, the shrubbery, the forest edge, and those kinds of thickets, not in the dense forest itself. So the caller here who has pine forest and a little bit more continuous forest, it may not be the most suitable habitat for the bird. So I think we've got a pretty good population in that northwest corner of Wisconsin. They've mm-hmm. pretty well established themselves up there. But being heavier forests up there, that may also restrict the numbers.
Pam, you could come down and see me in spring in my neighborhood because it's full of cardinals. Yeah. And it's really I love it, going out for my morning runs in the spring in the morning and hear the cardinals going back and forth.
And I would suggest if she's not surrounded by real dense mature forest right around the house, planting some shrubs and thickets and some shelter like that. And
that's a good idea
for both hiding places for roosting and for nesting sites. That might make it a little bit more attractive for those birds.
Christine in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Christine.
Yes, I'm interested in We live on Odana Road, right at the bottom near the Arboretum.
Yeah.
And for the last years, there's been quite a few crows around. We have a great variety of birds that come to our feeders, but there also were crows, and quite a few crows, and someone we would see sitting up on top of a big pine tree near us, and we called it being in the crow's nest, and it would send out messages when there was a hawk around. And some would come by our yard, and we would take out a piece of bread and leave it for them, and they'd all come. And there were several that just got the habit of coming and cawing to get us to come out to give them some.
Got you trained.
Are all gone. We don't even see many crows in the neighborhood or up around, and we've gotten to wonder, where did those crows go?
That is a good question. Crows are very close relatives to blue jays. They're both in the same family. And I've noticed on our Christmas bird counts that we conduct in Fond du Lac County, from year to year, the numbers of crows and blue jays will really go up and down. So it seems that they shift quite a bit from year to year. Both those birds are somewhat flocking birds, crows in particular. Sometimes you'll see flocks literally in the hundreds. What brings them together? For what reason are they in such huge numbers? Good question. And then all of a sudden disperse and not be around the next year. I think it's just the whims of those birds. As generalists, there's an awful lot of food for them. Their diet is kind of covers a whole gamut. So it isn't necessarily food, but there's something else in their habits. And it's hard to explain what the comings and goings of those birds are. But I've certainly noticed that as well. Some years I am struggling to find fair numbers of crows on a Christmas bird count. Other times they may be one of the most abundant birds that we pick up.
So they may be back.
Yeah, just sort of a coming and going, or perhaps it was just a one-time peak and you may never see that incredible concentration. I've had that as well, where I've had several hundred crows in an area, really stands out, and they just don't seem to gather in that place again. And those numbers, what brought them there or what forced them to disperse, it's just mystery of the crows, I guess. It's their habits and whims.
There you go, Christine. Thank you so much for calling. Barbara in Grand Marsh, we turn to you now. Hi, Barbara.
Hello. I'm calling you because we were in Corkscrew Swamp in Florida, and as we were walking along the boardwalk, now I have to say I live in Wisconsin, so seeing robins is wonderful, but all of a sudden the ranger came slowly walking up to us, and she said, shush, 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 if you're very, very quiet, if you walk a little further, you'll see a robin.
It is not a common bird down in Florida. So it's kind of a treat for them. It's kind of interesting as you travel around the country that birds that seem to be so commonplace in one area are something that is sought after by bird watchers and others. I've talked to people who've moved into the western states, and they say, gosh, I just miss the cardinal. I grew up, they were so commonplace, but now when I see it, it is just a real treat, and it's a specialty. And, of course, for us, in Wisconsin, travel out west, and there's going to be birds out there that we just will not see here. And if you're really kind of an avid bird watcher, it may be a life bird for you, something totally new. So, some of these birds are widespread across the country. Some of them are very restricted in their range. And for one group of people, what seems to be the most common bird and even boring for somebody else is a real treat.
It'd be a real treat to hear the cardinal. And I think Trina has got the cardinal. Let's just listen to the cardinal.
Sweet, sweet, cheer, cheer, cheer. It's that nice, clear whistle. That's what really stands out. There's a lot of variation, and so it's not so much necessarily the rhythm, but it's the voice. That's what we really go by. And we're going to start hearing that. We get out of this cold snap. We get toward the end of this month, early February. The first cardinals will start tuning up a little bit. It's well before the nesting season. They're still somewhat flocking up, so they're not yet becoming aggressive to claim territories. But I think there's a little practice going on. They just start tuning up a little bit, and it makes winter seem a little bit nicer. We get a couple of voices of these birds. So, yeah, we get a little bit later into the end of this month, early February, we'll start to hear the verse changes in the vocalizations of birds.
Jen in Madison emailed us. Her feeders are covered in snow. She's trying to get the food out there anyway. Mm-hmm. What's the best kind of food to provide? And I think you kind of you mentioned this earlier, but worth repeating. She has nuthatches and snowbirds or juncos and mm-hmm. chickadees, with a few cardinals and a few woodpeckers.
Well, for a variety of diets, a variety of foods. Certainly, the black oil sunflower seed is very much sought after. That's a good general seed. As I said earlier, it's a smaller sunflower seed, so some of the smaller birds can handle it as well. You could try a little bit of a mix of the cracked corn, millet, that type of food. As I said, I just happen to find it's not being heavily hit at my feeder, but that does not mean it holds true across the entire state. I also have suet for the woodpeckers. That is something that you can certainly offers another high-energy food for them. And then the Niger seed is another one that is easily handled by the smaller finches. As I said before, this is not really a big year for red poles and siskins. I have seen one single pine siskin in my backyard on one single occasion. They are not here this year. They either stayed in Canada or moved perhaps to New England or something. I haven't heard any reports from, say, across the northern U.S. to see where these birds may have invaded, but this is one of those eruptive populations, and for some reason they're not certainly not bailing out of Canada in huge numbers and heading our direction.
We have, let's see, Bill in Green Bay emailed us. I had mentioned sparrows earlier, and he says, speaking of sparrows, why does it seem they eat all day long at their feeders? When should he take down and clean his – and also another question, when should he take down and clean his birdhouses?
Well, the birdhouses, you can either clean those in fall or again in spring before the nesting season. I usually do it in spring. Snow melts. The birds are starting to come back. It'll take a while before they really start seeking out the bird houses for nesting space. So, yeah, and springtime is a good time. And also for your feeders, you want to keep those clean too, because you've got birds coming in or leaving droppings behind. And there's always that chance of salmonella, bacterial disease, that could be spreading. Just like the kid that has got the bad cough and goes to school, starts to spread it around the classroom. You get a sick bird coming into your feeder, and it could spread around the feeders as well. So periodically, when your feeders are empty, maybe right after this cold snap, next time your feeders are empty, bring them in, a little bit of warm water, bleach solution, rinse them well, let them dry out completely, and start over again, keep it clean. And since we've got quite a bit of snow on the ground, if you've got a lot of waste grain, the seed and bird droppings accumulating, just shovel that away or cover it up. I usually take it and just it sits on top of the snow. I scoop off that upper layer and throw that back away from the feeders so that we keep it nice and clean. So I think those are always good practices.
Yeah, and speaking of that, Pat in Wausau emailed us. A neighbor suggested that Pat is harming the wild bird population, especially goldfinches, with her feeders with thistle seed and wild birds no mess mix. He says she should stop it. She likes to feed them and wonders, is she putting them at risk? The neighbor says she'd reduce the risk if she just spread the seed on the ground.
No, I wouldn't agree with that. If you keep your feeders good and clean, because even on the ground is where the droppings are going to end up, there's a chance that right there on the ground that you could have the diseases being picked up. So either place, there's a chance for that infection. There was a survey that was done among the members of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, the statewide bird group, which is professional ornithologists and avid bird watchers. And they just asked people about any incidents of finding dead birds around the feeder, which probably relates to salmonella. And from the survey, it indicated that probably once in 20 years, there's a chance that you might have something like this. And of course, the good sanitation can reduce that. It is always that random chance that you could set up for an outbreak. If you ever should find a dead bird right around the feeders, yeah, then you want to shut it down, clean everything up, get those birds to disperse, start all over again, and to make sure that you're not setting up an epidemic, because we're feeding to help the birds and enjoy them. But as I said earlier, studies have indicated that even with bird feeders, good 75 to 80% of the food that most of these birds are getting is really from the wild.
Yeah.
We're feeding them more for ourselves than we are for them,
sure.
Except when we get these kinds of weather events. This might be the emergency food. This might be just what they need. So I always refer to this as like a fast food. It's quick, it's easy, it's convenient. The birds take advantage of it because it's there. And I suppose we've all done that as well mm-hmm. when we're on the road and busy. But if you've been traveling for a long way and haven't seen anything at all and you're starving, it may be the place yeah. that you want to pull in and sit down and eat something. So this might be really quite important for them.
Edie in Baraboo, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry.
Hi, good to hear your voice.
Oh, it's been a while.
Yeah.
I have got at least 20, 25 pine siskins at my feeder.
Oh, you do. Good for you. It's
yeah.
not been a common bird this year, and I've been hearing some reports from some of the bird watchers out there when they do see them, because this is not an invasion year. So good for you. You've got them. And, you know, this is always a good way to get an idea of what's going on in bird populations is when we have sort of a survey of enough people out there, which is where eBird reports come in. People who are watching birds have all them report their sightings, and it gives us a huge database. And I oftentimes hear from people, oh, a certain bird is just no longer in my backyard. 3 years ago, I had a lot of them. Where did they all go to? Well, it doesn't mean that the entire statewide population has crashed just because they're no longer common in your neighborhood. It may be just a temporary change in land use, habitat, or the whims of the birds themselves. But that's why we take a look at you know, a much more broad spectrum surveys like this.
Edie, what are you feeding them?
Black oil sunflower seeds and cracked corn.
Okay, good for you.
And I've got it all over, on the ground, in the feeders. And I also have a white-throated sparrow. Just one is all I've been able to find.
There's another one of those short-distance migrants. Most of them are going down to the southern states, but occasionally we'll have one hanging around. I had a fox sparrow a couple days ago. He
Whoa.
Showed up at my feeder. Again, another bird that does not migrate all that far, and this guy decided not to. So these are birds that will occasionally show up at feeders and even on the Christmas bird counts.
Mm-hmm. Edie, good to hear your voice again. Thank you for calling. And Judy and Custer, we'll go to you. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Larry and Bill. Last Christmas, when it was so snowy, I noticed that all the juncos were really couldn't get on all my hanging bird feeders. So I cleared off the deck and I started strewing what I just call scratch on it. And I was astonished at the numbers and different kinds of birds that I got. Mourning doves, for instance, and also tufted titmice. I didn't know they were here in the wintertime. And, of course, the cardinals and the blue jays and everybody else, as mm-hmm. lots and lots of finches. But anyway, I was just going to suggest that for those ground-feeding birds that really don't fit on the bird feeders, that finding a place on your deck to throw the seed out there is a good way to attract a lot of different ones.
That's yeah. a good suggestion, yeah. Scatter a little on the ground because especially juncos and mourning doves tend to feed more on the ground. They are not that comfortable feeding from feeders because their natural food is what they're scratching on the ground. But, of course, there again, you want to keep that clean of the waste grain and the droppings. So periodically a little bit of shoveling out there to keep that clean. And you did mention, by the way, the tufted titmouse. It's in the same family as the chickadee. And tufted titmouse is also not a migratory bird. That's another one that's been slowly advancing into Wisconsin over the last 30 years or so. And we're starting to see them show up a little bit more in different areas. I've had them for several years in my backyard. This year, none at the feeders. Hmm. It's apparently a very small neighborhood population right where I happen to live.
And there's Judy with the cleaning off her deck and using the deck and instead of the ground and
yes.
getting a good result.
Yeah, scattered out. And well, the nice thing about that is you're shoveling your deck anyhow. Right now you throw it on a foot of snow and
yeah.
a lot of that gets lost pretty easily and it's not that easy for the birds to feed on.
And thanks again, Judy, for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. And kind of go along with that, Kevin emailed us. He says, in addition to what you had to say, Bill, he's found that cardinals prefer or like platform feeders, open style fly through feeders, or the ground feeding. He uses an 80-20 mixture of black oil, sunflower, and safflower seeds, and that works well for him.
Oh, yeah. Yep. I don't use platform feeders only because of the squirrels.
And yeah.
I've had a little problem with that. I've tried them in the past, but then you get a squirrel in there, and he'll pound down enough food that in a half a day of what should last half a week for the birds. So every situation is going to be a little different for my backyard, and I think a little experimenting for what kinds of food and what kind of feeder it works best in your neighborhood. That's always worthwhile because there's no one, say, recipe or formula that's going to work for everyone.
Alan in Silver Lake called, couldn't stay with us, and wonders, with the demise of the fire control towers, wonders if these towers could be used as nesting sites, perhaps for bald eagles.
I would assume that if they were available for them, that they probably would have used them. You know what? One thing that's actually turning up quite a bit are the cell phone towers, and ravens apparently have been using them as well as some of the hawks. The ospreys have been on some of the cell phone towers. So those structures, well, we certainly have a lot more cell phone towers out there than we do the fire towers. And I don't know about what modifications would have to be made to it. It might be more expensive to get someone all the way up there and modify that to make it into a decent platform than it would be for what we have been doing with just erecting a different kind of artificial platform.
Connie in Menominee, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Connie.
Hi. I have plenty of finches, but they refuse to have anything to do with fresh Niger. They only want my sunflower seeds.
And when you're saying finches, is that purple finch and house finch or goldfinches?
No, it's house finch, goldfinch. I haven't had any pine siskins or anything, but mm-hmm. I have lots of finches, but they detest or don't have anything to do with my Niger.
Goldfinches are probably the more likely one to take it, though they can handle even the black oil sunflower seed. When you get to the house finch and purple finch, they've got a little bit larger bill, a little larger bird, so they're going to take more of the larger seeds. That's going to suit them a little better. And, I guess just try a variety of foods, do a little experimenting with it, and if it's not working out or if it's not working this year, maybe if we get a pine siskin or red pole invasion again, you might want to switch over to the Niger. The one thing I should always mention about Niger is that among all the different kinds of seed, it seems to be something that spoils easily. And I've noticed this when I used to feed a lot of Niger, that if all of a sudden a tube feeder is full and the birds are not hitting it, I just dump it, I put it in the compost, and I start over again or get a new bag. And that's one seed that you want to buy from a store that's got a good turnover of it.
Hmm.
So, you know, the small hardware store that has a couple of bags on the side that just as an offering, great for sunflower, it's convenient, you can buy it there. But the Niger, if it sits too long, there's not a lot of demand for it, it may actually spoil. And with that might be another reason that the birds are not hitting it. It's just old seed. And I'm not sure what it is about Niger, why it spoils, or even how birds can tell.
Yeah.
But for some reason, I've noticed this, and I've heard this from others, that sometimes it just seems to be a bad batch or an old batch. So look for a store that's got a good turnover, a good area of, you know, a lot of sales, and that's where you want to buy your Niger so it's fairly fresh.
Thanks, Connie. Appreciate the call. Bill Volkert, our guest today as we talk birds. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking birds with our guest Bill Volkert back with us, our retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist. He's done this for many a year. He's been on the show, and it's always great to have him with us as we talk birds. I wanted to hear a chickadee. Have we got any chickadee sounds in there? I think we got a black cap.
This is something that we'll also start to hear in the next couple of weeks. Now, most people think of chickadee as the chickadee-dee-dee. which is actually a call, and that's a warning. So when you walk into the woods and disturb the birds, that's why you'll hear that. Or if there's a predator nearby. And research seems to indicate the number of DDDD that they add to it is a little bit more the intensity.
Really.
So the more excited they get about it, they'll add that. So calls are the vocalizations that birds make throughout the year. Contact, just staying in touch in a flock. You know, here I am. Everything's good. No problem. Warning. Look out. Danger. Something like that. Songs is what they do to establish a territory and lure a mate. And that is the song of the chickadee. And it's interesting because for most birds, the song is the more complicated, much more elaborate vocalization, where calls are just chip-chatter, little squeaks and things. For the chickadee, the song is the simplest one, just the little two notes. And as I said, just like the cardinal, they'll start in the next couple of weeks. So you'll start to hear them in this late winter. It livens things up a little bit in the woods when you know spring is still a ways away.
Terry in Cuba City sent us a photo of a bird that died maybe from hitting a window in his house in Grant County during the summer and wondered what it was, and it reminded him of a flycatcher. Is that what he was seeing?
Yeah, looking at the picture, it appears to be a great crested flycatcher. He's got it in the hand. We're looking at the belly of it. I can see the beak that looks like the flycatcher. The better field mark would be if you could see the edge of the wing and especially the tail. He's got this a very reddish-brown color to it. It's one of our larger flycatchers. It's in the genus Myarchus, which for us in the eastern United States, that's easy because it's the only one we have. But as you get into Central America, where they're spending the winter, there's a number of very close lookalikes down there that they join at this time of the year. So it's a fairly large group of flycatchers.
Tim in Madison has something. Let's go there. Hi, Tim.
Hi. It's a little bit different than the songbirds, but in November, I had been up to Superior to visit my son, and we went up way up on the ridge, you know, overlooking Duluth to a bird watching station.
Oh,
and
Hawk Ridge.
The golden, that was it. And we were watching the golden eagles migrate down the North Shore.
Oh, good.
And
for
that
you.
Was crazy. And I'd never heard of that, you know, in this neck of the woods. So I was just wondering if you could comment more about that, and I'll listen on the radio. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, Hawk Ridge has been set up as a observation area for hawk counts for many, many years. I was up there, it was in the 1970s, and they were already stationing up there. There's another one very similar out in Pennsylvania, Hawk Mountain. Of course, these are good hawk observation areas. So what's happening is the hawks are coming out of Canada in the wintertime, in the fall time, and they don't like to go over water. So if you kind of imagine Lake Superior, you've got that long north shore. Yeah. They're coming along, hitting that, and they're following the shore. And as these birds are hitting that, they start to funnel down. And right there north of Duluth, they just concentrate before they get around the bend of Lake Superior and spread out across Wisconsin, Minnesota, heading south. It's a great area to count the birds. And so, the surveys that are done on golden eagles, on the broadwing hawks, and others that are coming down there, it gives us a pretty good survey point of those birds because it's this bottleneck for them.
What's the status of the golden eagle?
Well, the golden eagle is really a western bird. So it's more found in the western United States and nesting up into Canada. In Wisconsin, it was a bird that we thought of as really being uncommon. And one of the problems is that bald eagles, which are so widespread these days, they don't get that white head and tail till they're about 4 or 5 years old. And so you have these immature plumages. And there's that speckling of white under the wing. And they can look a little like golden eagles, and especially the immatures of both. Well, a number of years ago, people were reporting sightings, especially in western Wisconsin, back from the Mississippi River along the driftless area of the Bluff Country, and recognizing that there were bald eagles. And there were some questions. Are you sure it's bald eagle? Golden eagle, not immature bald. And so people were reporting these birds, and those with a little more experience, a little more time, kept saying, no, we are seeing them here, and we're starting to do counts. So back within the last 10 years, they started doing workshops for observers, get together, show you all the plumages of the immature bald eagle, the different plumages of young and adult golden eagle. Make sure you know what you're looking at and get people to scatter out there. And on one day, do a survey. And we're finding that there's probably 15, 20, 30 golden eagles that from year to year, especially in that western part of the Wisconsin, that are wintering there. A bird that we normally think of as found out west. So it seems that we are a little bit of a wintering site for at least a small proportion of that population. As you get out in the western states, I say they're much more common there. And by the way, the golden eagle is also found in parts of Asia. In Mongolia, it's a fairly common bird there.
We have Vivian in Green Bay with something. Let's go there. Vivian, hi.
Hello. My feeders are overrun with the English sparrows. And if I put my feet on the ground, there'll be one cardinal and 30, 40 sparrows. So a little difficult. But what I found is I have a service berry bush.
Mm-hmm.
And if I throw the feed among the shoots and the roots, the chickadees and the cardinals are better able to feed alongside the sparrows. They're not flushed as quickly by the sparrows because of that cover, maybe?
Oh, yeah, it could be. And also sparrows like to feed a little bit more on open ground where those birds are used to being in those edges and thickets. Yeah, that's a bird that, of course, was introduced in the United States, has become fairly common, especially around urban areas, and can dominate feeders. Something you might want to try is just stick with some of the larger seeds, the sunflower and even regular sunflower seeds, the striped sunflower, because that's a seed that's a little large for the house sparrow or English sparrow to handle. See if that can't reduce it a little bit.
Good idea. And kind of along with that, Steve has some advice for the lady who had the Cooper Hawks.
Mm-hmm.
He had the same problem. He set up an umbrella over the bird bath, some sort of arrangement, and the Coopers couldn't see the birds at the bath from
above.
Well,
that's the idea. Yeah, he's screening them so that they can come in, and because he's a sight feeder, and he's going to try to ambush them. So, yeah, a little bit of shelter like that might be a solution.
Jay in Two Rivers, thank you for calling.
Yes, good morning. I've got an observation on bird feeders and a possible solution for squirrels for some people. For the last 40 years, we've tried a variety of bird feeders and found that they do prefer a covered platform feeder. Looks like a gazebo. We did try a real good weighted perch feeder that keeps the squirrels off, but the birds rarely frequented it, and I believe it's because they're blind on one side and can't see predators. So we finally took it down because it wasn't used.
Mm-hmm.
But being retired now and we're able to see the birds frequently, our Australian Shepherd needs something to do. And I managed to train her to chase the squirrels away when they decide to perch in that platform feeder.
Keeps the dog and the squirrels busy.
Oh, she loves it. And I can let her out the front or the back door, and she'll rip around and chase them. And when she'll let them get away every time because I guess she just wants to herd and not chew them up. So I just thought I'd pass that along.
Jay, thank you.
Works for you.
Works for you, yeah. and why not?
Yeah, squirrels can be a challenge. As I said, you know, earlier, they can eat an awful lot of food in a short amount of time compared to a flock of birds. And that's where it gets frustrating for people when they're dominating it. You'll see on the market a number of so-called squirrel-proof feeders. I've got one that's spring-loaded. I don't think it's so much the spring that keeps them out. It's got a metal housing over on top, so the squirrels have a hard time hanging on, and they can't climb down it to where the food is available on the bottom. Plus, it's out on a pole off the deck, so it makes it a little bit more challenging for the squirrels to get out there. I've always been of the mind, though, that the feeders are, that they advertise are probably more accurately referred to as squirrel resistant and squirrel proof. I think by the time you have something that's 100% squirrel proof, it's also going to be bird proof. They're pretty clever. So it can be a bit of a trick to try to keep the squirrels off.
Mike in St. Lawrence. Hi.
Hi, guys. Just as I was talking to your screener, I heard the word flycatcher, and of course that was about my question, so you must have been talking about them when I was talking to the screener. But anyway, I have a flycatcher, I believe it's a flycatcher, nested on the corner of my house this past summer, and I was amazed how that little bird, it had three eggs, only two of them survived, one was still in the nest. But he would land, and it's about 10 feet off the ground. He would fly from the nest and drop down on the driveway, pick up a bug, and go back up to the nest. And he would have different points around my driveway, which is clear of the woods. The rest is all woods. And he would go to these different points, and he'd sit there during the day, and he'd go down and catch bugs. Sometimes he'd swoop them out of the ground, out of the air. I was just amazed. I'd never seen, and he would hover like a hawk.
Yeah, a little acrobat. This was mostly a grayish bird?
Yeah, grayish with some kind of a greenish. Maybe belly on the bottom?
Yeah, off-white. Yeah, it's a tan. Nesting under the eaves of a house?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the Eastern Phoebe. It's the most common of the flycatchers to nest around our house. And, yeah, a little bit of a nesting platform put right under the eaves of the house is a great place for it.
Mike, thanks for that story. Appreciate it. Bill Volkert, our guest, right up until 12:30 today. We'll take a quick look at the news. And then we'll be back with Bill. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at bird watching today and bird feeding with our guest, Bill Volkert. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. Bill, a retired wildlife educator and naturalist. Great to have him back with us. And I hope you'll join in with your own experiences or your own questions relating to birds. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Bill, we've got the Great Backyard Bird Count coming up in mid-February, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it's the 16th to the 19th this year, and they're just asking people to count the birds at their feeders. It's another great look at bird populations in wintertime when they're pretty well settled in, and creates a huge database by just asking everybody out there who's looking out their window at their feeders, what are you seeing? And if you're looking for a little bit of the background information, how to count, and where to report, just search on the computer, just take a look for Great Backyard Bird Count, and they'll give you information of just simply how to do that and how to enter your count and be part of literally millions of people across the United States who are sharing their observations of birds.
And birdcount.org is on our website. So if you go to ideas@wpr.org/Larry, take a look. We'll have that posted. You can just click right on it from there.
Excellent.
There we go. Mark in Egg Harbor has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Mark.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. During the summer, long summer days, in the evenings, I hear this bird that sounds very fluty. I think it's a vireo. That sound...
Yeah, a flute-like call is usually members of the thrush family, the wood thrush, in northern central Wisconsin, the hermit thrush. These are both common birds. So the vireo is perhaps not vireo. The vireo is maybe the one that you're referring to. This is a bird of some of the lowland thickets, and this is usually where you find them. Alder swamps is a fairly common type of habitat for them, or some of the willow thickets. And, yeah, you might want to just take a look for go to All About Birds and just type in vireo. You can also check some of the other thrushes and see if that's not the vocalization. It gets its name from the call, and it is a very wishy kind of a very, 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 very.
Yep, there you go. Mark, good luck. Thank you. Dan in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Dan.
Yeah, I just had some questions and maybe just some thoughts from your guest. I see on Facebook and a lot of other different pages that I follow with birding, a lot of people have these feeders out, but then they are seeing non-native species, particularly starlings, taking over these feeders. And I feel like a very simple answer, one that I'm really passionate about, is implementing native habitat and plants into your yard or your space or property, rather than putting out bird feeders to kind of stifle these non-native species from taking hold and taking advantage of the free feed. Is there any type of assistance or programs that folks can use in urban and rural settings to place native habitat?
I don't know about assistance for that, but there certainly are a lot of recommendations from Audubon Society. A number of other groups have.
Extension even has.
Yeah, Extension.
Attracting birds, the plants that you can plant.
There you go. Yeah, a lot of good references and material. And, you know, we talked about the house sparrows, how they like these big open areas. So, yeah, adding a little bit more shrubbery might make it less attractive for them and certainly more attractive for some of our native birds, such as cardinals that we talked about earlier. I wouldn't say to cut out the bird feeding, but I would say to supplement it. And, you know, for like anything, the birds need their food, water, and shelter. And I think this is something that we oftentimes miss. We put out bird baths, even the heated bird bath in wintertime that people will put out there, will fill the feeders. Well, that's the food and the water. The shelter is what we're missing. And landscaping your backyard is really the way to help the birds, both for migrants that are coming through as a stopover in your backyard from those long journeys. If they're coming from, say, Central America, heading to northern Wisconsin or Canada, they need places to stop and rest and refuel along the way, and for other birds to actually nest and use it during the summertime. So these long winter days might be a good time to look at that bare backyard. Draw out a little bit of a plan of where you want to plant some shrubs. Stick with the native shrubs. Look for some of these suggestions of things online as references, and look for nurseries that carry those that can help you to make it a much more bird-friendly backyard.
Thank you, Dan. Appreciate it. Thomas in Manitowoc, on to you now. Hi, Thomas.
Hi, Bill. I just wanted to ask you, how do the golden eagles get along with the bald eagles? Do they overlap? And I think the reason that we don't have them here in Wisconsin is we don't have a lot of rock walls here for them to nest, I would assume. And I also wanted to say, if you want to watch a great video, if you look up hunting wolves with eagles in Mongolia, it's just awesome to see the power of the eagles. These horsemen have been doing this there for, I don't know, hundreds or thousands of years, and they train the eagles to hunt these wolves, and it's just amazing to watch. And
yeah, Mongolia, they actually do it as a falconry. They'll actually train the eagles, where here they're just a wild bird.
Mm-hmm. And is there a competition thing between the golden and the?
Not really, because first of all, a bald eagle is primarily a fisher. So fish is a big diet when there's open water for them. They will scavenge, of course, in the wintertime, especially on roadkills, where the golden eagle is an upland hunter. So they'll be taking rabbits and small game, and occasionally, as he had indicated, some of the much larger mammals out west. It's not unusual, say, for something as big as a young mountain goat or one of the sheep. The wild sheep out there is occasionally taken, so they can handle a pretty large prey item.
Even
so, it's quite a difference in diet.
Some of our one of my listeners sent a video of a bald eagle taking a fawn that happened to be in the water.
Yes, you shared that with me, that video, and I think what made it so outstanding is that is really out of the norm for them. But like any predator, I mean, they are opportunists. If there's a chance, they may just give it a try. It's not part of the diet. I mean, that's what made that so unique, is that it was very exceptional for a bald eagle to go after that kind of food.
Pat in Port Washington. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks, Larry and Bill. I just had a quick question. I bought some feed at a reputable feed farm store, because I wanted to supplement my black oil sunflower.
Mm-hmm.
And it's shelled sunflower seeds, it's millet, raisins, peanut shelled and unshelled, and the birds will not touch it. and I'm wondering if it was bad. And of course, I dumped it in my airtight container and threw the bag away. So
it's usually more than Niger seed that I'm familiar with that's spoiling. Hard to say, especially since you've got such a variety and such a mix. Even if they don't like everything in there, there should be something to be picking through. It's kind of like me with Gorp and trail mix. I would just go for the M&Ms. But you would think that something in there would be attractive to the birds, even if it's not everything. That is peculiar. Maybe try to just spread a little on the ground and see if something's going to pick at it. Find a way to make some use of it. Offer it to them. If not, I really wouldn't know why they'd be rejecting it entirely.
Yeah. Thanks for calling, Pat. Appreciate it. Larry in Bloomington, Minnesota, will go to you. Hi.
Good morning. We live in a Wooded Creek south of Minneapolis, and we get a lot of woodpeckers on our suet. Mm-hmm. And yesterday I was looking for we get pileated now and then, but I thought it was a red belly, and it was a huge flicker that came. So that was very unusual for us to come to see that bird, which is very unusual around here. But also, just to add your juncos on the deck, what I've taken is my wife had an old cookie sheet, and I use that. I put the seed on that, and the juncos eat it, and then it's easy to keep clean. I just turn it upside down.
Oh, that's
and
a
lastly,
good idea.
In terms of the Niger, to keep it fresh, and I've noticed the same thing you mentioned, I keep it in the garage in the wintertime, and in the summer I actually put the Niger in the freezer, and it seems to keep a lot longer, so the birds love it more.
Good suggestion. Yeah, I like the idea of the cookie sheet because it's something that you can easily clean then. Doesn't matter how much snow you have. It's something that you can offer the food on, and you can wash off the droppings and start all over with a clean slate.
Yeah. Thanks, Larry. And Karen has from Madison has something to add in that area as well. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I love it when you guys come on together.
Oh, thank you very much.
I'm feeding the bird, whoever's here. It's just the squirrels really like to take over, and I just try to spread it around on the ground, even in the feeder, because the squirrels will eventually take it, and I just try to keep. I worry about disease, so I try and keep it clean, and just spread it around. So they aren't all on top of each other.
Oh, good for you.
You know, that's the best thing you can do for them, I think. And just to add, I've got evergreen trees, and I put the food under there for cover. Just make sure that you get the snow off first so you don't have an avalanche and you know.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, that'd be a waste of the seed to put it out there and have the snow come falling down and bury it.
Good tip, Karen.
Yeah, those are great ideas.
Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Mark emailed us, and I wondered if you could comment on the whippoorwill population and ways he could help them.
Oh, we've had calls on that over the years. And, yeah, that's a bird that is not that common in Wisconsin anymore. And we're really not sure if it's problems here on the nesting grounds, if it's changes in the wintering grounds, which is mostly southern Mexico, Central America. We're not sure of the cause. And this is always the problem with bird monitoring is the first thing to do is to survey them and see what the trend is. Are they holding their own? Are they actually increasing? Or are we seeing declines? For those that we start to see declines, the next question is, what's the problem and what can we do about it? And for whippoorwills, we certainly know there is a decline. There's been a real retreat of these birds. We're seeing them primarily in that southwest and west central part of Wisconsin, but we're not really sure what the cause is. They nest on the ground in forested areas, so it's not a bird that we could say help outright. But we're still trying to put our finger on what the cause is and see what we can do there. It does not seem to be nesting habitat availability, though.
Mike from Algoma has birds roosting under a small back porch in the winter. They use this porch daily, so he's wondering if the birds might be disturbed by walking over, in that area at night while they're sleeping.
Yeah, in the nighttime, you could be spooking them out of the roost site if that's what they're using in the evening. I'm not sure if it's just something they're retreating to get away from the sight of predators and just to get out of the wind during the daytime, which is I'm thinking it's more likely they're using that during the daytime rather than throughout the entire night. I guess the only way to know that is if you walk outside and you're actually seeing the birds flushing.
Yeah. Jim in Mauston wonders, if you don't have heated waterers in the freezing weather, can you fill a you know, 4 or 5 inch diameter container with hot water? Might not freeze for over an hour or two, but would it be beneficial for the birds?
I guess it depends on how much time you've got on hand, because yeah, it will freeze in these temperatures fairly quickly. So you know, you'd have to keep going out there to freshen that up throughout an entire day. Yeah, the heated bird bath would probably be the best way to go if you want to keep an open water source available for the birds.
Mary in Oconto County emailed us. She's got many birds in her feeders, at least 25 pine siskins and many goldfinches.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, along with typical songbirds and even a grackle that showed up around Christmas with a juvenile red-winged blackbird. The blackbird is gone, but the grackle's still here. Plus, she's blessed to live in an area that has all types of woodpeckers, including pileated and even an occasional sighting of red-headed.
Oh, that's nice.
Man. Now,
red-headed is another one that we don't have the numbers of that we did years ago. There seems to be a good population yet in the southwestern part of Wisconsin. And most of our woodpeckers are year-round residents. Red-headed woodpeckers, flickers, and sapsuckers, they're migrants. So occasionally we'll find them in the wintertime. There's always a chance for a few stragglers. When we did the Christmas bird count, that was still in December. For our area, and it was still incredibly mild. I had in a single place that I stopped, I had 7 flickers still hanging out as a little group out there. I'm sure that they, a lot of them departed once the weather got to be a little more severe.
I have an interest. I always like red-headed woodpeckers, and you hardly ever see them. I've got a wood-carved red-headed woodpecker on a piece of wood.
Oh, yeah, that is a spectacular bird. My recommendation, if you want to see red-headed woodpeckers, if you have a little time in springtime, take a trip out to Nisida National Wildlife Refuge.
Ah.
There's an area that they've been doing some savanna restoration. So they've been opening up the large mature trees with spaces between them and grassland understory, native grasses. And that is the habitat that those birds originally associated with. And, yeah, you can actually see almost flocks of them out there. That is really a good stronghold. So that is where the birds still seem to have a core population, is that west central, southwestern part of the state.
Lance emailed us. He has a tiny saw-whet owl that hangs out at his place and is very friendly, and wonders, are they all this friendly? He's taken pictures of them even, and he poses and is not fearful of Lance at all.
Well, very lucky. It's a fairly common owl, but they're so small and so secretive, they're rarely seen or known about for most people. There's an actual migration of them in October, early November, and there's a few places in Wisconsin, especially Woodland Dunes. They've been doing bird banding out there and capturing them and marking them, and there's really good movements of them. But here's a bird that hides during the day, is active in the evening time, and then migrates out of Wisconsin. I mean, he's tiny. He's barely, say, 6 inches tall,
yeah.
5-6 inches. But, yeah, it's also a bird that on occasion, if you can find them, they're just not shy of humans. So, yeah, lucky for him. Very nice. That's a great bird.
Jenny in Madison takes people's Christmas trees off the side of the road or street and puts them next to her feeder. Just gives the birds an extra place to shelter in the cold.
That's a great idea. It's a good use of the Christmas tree for this time of the year. Of course, I would encourage a little bit more permanent plantings as well to go along with that. But you've got to think of a bird. If you're just watching your bird feeder, they come in, they'll stop, they'll pause, they'll look left, right, grab a seed, look back again, fly somewhere, check over their shoulder, peck at that seed. They're always watching because at any second, there's a chance for a predator to be coming in, so they're extremely wary. Well, if you've got your bird feeder out in a wide open with no shelter nearby, that is a risk for them to make a dash to go to that food and have no place to hide. So that's why the landscaping is going to be important, to provide that shelter, make them feel safe, and really make it a lot easier for them to approach those feeders and to retreat back into.
Gail wonders if you could address the importance of providing a water source for birds.
Well, everything's frozen this time of the year, so yeah, that's something that certainly can be quite beneficial. And so, as we said earlier, you're going to have a heated bird bath. So, and birds can find some moisture out there. Eating snow is not the most efficient. There's not a lot of moisture in snow, and it chills the body temperature down to do so. But, yeah, bird bath with a little heater in there can be quite important. The other thing, as long as we're looking out our windows and enjoying birds and filling our feeders, something I also would really encourage homeowners to do is not just look at their landscaping, but also take a look at the protections on the windows. It's certainly not uncommon for most people to hear a little thump of a bird hitting a window, and it's not unusual for the bird to hit the window, try to get himself together again, and then fly off. But we don't know what the long-term health is. Are there internal injuries? Are there something they may succumb to? If we can make those windows more visible for those birds, as long as we're trying to lure them into our backyards, make sure we get rid of those hazards. And there's a number of different window protections out there. You can check with the American Bird Conservancy for bird-safe windows, and a lot of manufacturers are gearing up with that. I did that at our house, and it was out of necessity. It was just really unfortunate when I would see birds slam into the windows and find something dead laying right there by the house. And especially since birds is something I've been studying and working with for my whole life, I did not want to be a cause of those kinds of mortalities. So we put some striping on the window. It has been cut down to just about zero. I'll occasionally hear a little tap on the window or find a feather there, but the birds are already braking. They're slowing their speed down and just hitting that window very lightly, if at all, and that's maybe twice a year that I have even that much. I have not had a single dead bird at my windows ever since I put that up. So I would really encourage homeowners to take a look at that and make it a more bird-safe environment.
And Francis lives in Kansas, emailed us, wonders about the decline in the great horned owl population.
There's that evening call, and they're going to start tuning up. They'll be nesting fairly soon.
Is there a problem with the great horned owl?
No, not that we know of. Now, owls are going to be a little difficult to survey real thoroughly because they're somewhat solitary. They're widespread, and you know they only call so occasionally. Mm. So it's hard to get a good census, but it does not seem to be a bird of concern. This may be an occasion where it is that person's backyard and neighborhood where the owls are no longer using it. They're also cavity nesters, so maybe a large tree came down that they're using or something changed with the local type of habitat that they don't have a suitable nesting site. But overall, it seems like it's a fairly stable population, and it's just the kind of bird that is fabulous to see because it's not a common sight.
Yeah, it is. And Francis also said he's seen an increase in the barred owl population in the area.
Oh.
So
I don't know if
news.
There's a correlation between the two.
Yeah.
I think they're both pretty compatible with each other.
Well, on that note, we are out of time, Bill. Thank you so much for visiting with us. It's always great to see you and great to have you in the studio, and we'll look forward to another visit. Thanks, Bill.
Always my pleasure. Thank you so much, Larry.
Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist, and he'll be back and we'll talk with you again about birds. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about your car. Winter's a time when you want your car to be reliable. And we'll talk about what to watch for under the hood tomorrow at 11. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.